Welcome, everybody, to the Diecast Movie Podcast. For this episode, we have a special interview brought to you by my dad. Take it away, Dad.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Diecast Movie Podcast, where we do movies. We discuss movies that are decided by the roll of the die, and we also do interviews. And today, I'm lucky to have Marcia Dietlin. Oh, I had it right. Marcia Dietlin Bennett, who's going to be joining me today to She's been in many different movies. I like a lot of them that are done by Danny Roebuck, Getting Grace, Lucky Louie, which we've talked about on the show before. But also, she harkens back to horror roots with Return of the Living Dead Part 2 and numerous TV guest spots on shows like Law & Order, Matlock, you know, Texas Ranger, a whole bunch of different things. Welcome to the show, Miss Bennett.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you accepted to do the interview. And like I said, I've seen you in some of your recent work with Danny Roebuck and Getting Grace, where you played the mom for Madeline Dundon's character, Grace. And I really loved your portrayal in there because you had the arc. And you and Danny had the arcs in the movie, you know, to go through, because Grace was pretty much status quo. So you two had the big journeys in it. And before we get into those two movies, though, I really want to find out, what got you into acting? What was it that started you down this path?
Well, when I was like 8 years old in elementary school and the teacher was like asking all the kids what they want to be when they grow up, I would always say I wanted to be an actor. So it was like, that's what I wanted to be. And or actress. We were allowed to say actress back then. and then I pretty much just kept, taking any opportunity I could. So I did musicals in middle school. I did the musicals and plays in high school. And then I went to college just for a year, but for theater. And then at 18, after that year, I ended up in Los Angeles. And, I was like, this is my goal. So I went to Los Angeles and did a lot of plays out there and then started working in television.
What was one of your favorite plays that you got to do either in high school, college, or that when you're in Los Angeles?
I have two plays that I really loved in Los Angeles. The first one was an Alan Ayckbourn play called Woman in Mind, but it starred Helen Mirren. So I got to do a play with Helen Mirren, and I was like 26 years old. I think she was in her 40s, and I just thought she was the coolest person I had ever met in my life. And she was amazing, and we had so much fun together. It was a small little 99-seat theater, and she was already pretty famous, and everybody came to the play, and then we'd go out to, like, the punk rock club afterwards and hang out and stuff. So that was incredible fun for me. I haven't seen her since then, but I would love to, because I would love to, like, say, hey, remember how much fun we had? But she was an inspiration to me, for sure. And then probably the next favorite play I've done, I did a play at the Mark Schaefer Forum, which is a big theater in Los Angeles, and I was part of a classical theater company, and we did a Chekhov play called The Wood Demon, which is the first play that Chekhov ever wrote, and it's kind of a happy version of Uncle Vanya, which became, you know, one of his masterpieces and stuff. So that was incredible. The costumes were beautiful, and I was working with all my friends in this theater company, and we had a great time.
I love live theater. My daughter has a theater degree. Hers is always the one of the stage hands. She was the prop mistress for her 4 years of college and working on those different things. So I always appreciate when I go to see live theater, not just what the actors do, but I'm also thinking about the people we never see who are doing all these great things. So the performance is great for that night.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you all become a family when you're doing a play, cast and crew across the board. And it's really a wonderful experience that way.
And I know, because this is an audio podcast, people can see, but when she was saying Helen Mirren, my jaw was open because, you know, I was just like, I don't know how long was that play? How long was that production?
We did it, I think, for like 3 months, maybe 3 or 4 months. In Los Angeles, so I got to hang out with Helen Mirren every day. It's pretty cool.
I met 3 or 4 months, like, yeah, we're going here, we're going there. This is my pal.
It was pretty great.
And I'm just curious, was there anything that you learned from watching her perform that you've taken to heart and utilized in the rest of your career? I'm sure there has to be at least a few nuggets that you picked up from her.
One of the things that I loved about her is she's very naughty on stage, and she would turn her back to the audience and like make faces at you and do all kinds of things to try to make you laugh and everything. And I think that that was so great, because even though she was like the consummate professional, she still had a lot of fun in what she was doing. And then there was a couple of times this other actor, Paxton Whitehead, who's this very British guy, was a British playwright. And he would miss an entrance. And this is a small theater where like dressing rooms were on either side of the stage. And the entrance to the stage was stage right. His dressing room was stage left. And you'd hear him like bump, 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 running back because he had missed his entrance. And Helen would always just like look at me like, So I'd have to start ad-libbing and try to figure out what to say to fill the space because Paxton wasn't coming on stage. And she was very, very fun and spontaneous to work with. So I definitely took that with me. I'm not that naughty on stage, but I do love like the spontaneity and the playfulness and like, you know, let's not take this too seriously and have some fun.
I love it because there's some performers, they're able to pull that off where they're able to go out of character and pop into character so seamlessly. And there's other people that have to stay in it the whole time. And if they get thrown off and they totally go downhill. I know from as an audience member, when you're watching live theater, it's great because each night it's like tailor made for you. And I like it when I can pick up on stuff like that when it's happening. You can see that somebody got somebody else to laugh, and now they just realize, oh, we got them with the giggles. Let's keep piling on. And you know it was probably an ongoing thing for the whole show, you know, all the different things. But you that night, they finally got them, or they've gotten them before. We'll never know. But my night, Robert Goulet broke character and could not stop laughing while he was playing King Arthur.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I'm sure the whole audience was laughing with him.
We all were. It was just funny because it took him at least a minute and a half to get his composure again. And I was 5 or 6 rows away. You could see his whole face was red. I mean, he had totally lost in it. And it was hilarious. It was just one of those things. It was so human. And that's the thing. It was just, you learned to love the actor even more because they're trying to get their composure, get back. And I know some people might think it's like, oh, how dare he lose character? But I enjoy that part because that's my performance.
Yes, I love that.
So you were doing theater out in Los Angeles. How did you get into movies, you know, with Return of the Living Dead Part 2? How did that happen?
Well, okay, that was literally maybe my 6th or 7th audition that I had in Los Angeles. I had done a couple of commercials before that, but I had just auditioned for very few sort of, you know, legit things. And I got the audition. I remember I just laughed because I was like, oh my gosh, this is how every actor gets their start. You know, back in the 80s, they all had to star in a horror film, right? And so I auditioned and they called me back. We had a lot of callbacks. I remember the final callback was between, I had flown home to Ohio for Christmas and they called me and they wanted me to come in between Christmas and New Year's for the final callback. So I had to fly back to Los Angeles. And then at that callback, I was paired up with Dana Ashbrook, who ended up getting the part, and Michael Kenworthy, who played my little brother in it. We were paired up together and then we all got cast together. So that was really fun.
That's so cool because, you know, sometimes you hear these stories where people are, you know, having to go from tons and tons of stuff. At least it was like an early Christmas. Well, I shouldn't say an early Christmas present because you had to go back between. So I guess it was after Christmas. So it was like a belated Christmas gift. We need you to come back.
It was. It was like the best, you know, Happy New Year you could get. And then we started filming very shortly after that. I think maybe 2-3 weeks after that. So that's why they had to have that callback during the holidays. But it was a great present.
And what was it like working on it, you know, and doing the production? Because here you're working with the zombies, and of course this is the comedic zombie movie, so it's kind of a different take than a lot of people are used to with the George Romero type.
Right. I feel like I didn't really pick up on the comedy of it that much. I was very serious. No, I knew it was a comedy, but that was up for like Jimmy Caron and Tom Matthews. They got to do all like the funny stuff. I just couldn't believe I was like a lead in a movie, and it was so much fun because, you know, it was shot for like two and a half months, and half the time you're shooting nights, so you really become a vampire. Like, you know, you go to work at 5-6 in the evening, and you finish when the light comes up in the morning. And so you really could just kind of immerse yourself in this crazy zombie world. But I remember showing up on set, and I was just like, I didn't know anything. You know, they're like, oh, here's your mark, and here's your light and all this stuff. And I just pretended like I knew exactly what I was doing, even though I didn't know anything. And, you know, it was a great sort of first job because it was for 10 weeks. So you did really get a chance to learn so much about making a movie. And it was so different from theater because, you know, the zombies, they are there, but in your shot, when it's like your close up, it's just the director going, you know, okay, here's the zombie. Okay, look at him here. Okay, now he's over here. Okay, scream. You know, so it's much more like in your brain, in your head, what's going on. Because if you're in a play, what's going on is going on. You know, if the phone rings and you pick it up. But in a movie, they go, okay, the phone rings and you go, oh, okay, you know. And so it was a whole different level, I feel, of imagination that you had to kind of create inside your brain instead of just being in the real world of the play. You were in this movie world, and it was a different process, but I loved it.
It's almost sounds like when you talk to people that worked with CGI or with stop motion, and the creatures are not there, but you have to picture there. Of course, your difference is there are scenes where you actually have the zombies in the shots, so you're able to at least see them, so you have an idea.
Yeah, I don't think there's any CGI in our movie because I don't think that really, maybe at the end when they all get electrocuted, but oh, sorry, spoiler alert. The zombies die. but yeah, no, all that was what was sort of great. The effects in our movie are incredible. This guy, Kenny Myers, came up with all the makeup effects and all the robots and everything. And he just was kind of a master makeup artist and a special effects artist. And, that was cool because what you see is real in there. You know, we're not acting in front of a green screen with zombies being superimposed. They really are like people in makeup and all of that. So that was really cool.
Oh, I understood that. I was just meaning like when you were doing your close up and they were just saying picture the zombie here and there.
Exactly.
That is similar to the CGI type things that are going on nowadays or the stop motion back in the old day. But the difference is when they're telling them, well, this is what it's going to look like. And sometimes they'll show them a picture. You were able to at least say, oh, no, at least I know exactly what the zombie looks like. Cause there it is over there, you know, standing waiting for their scene. So so it helped your imagination. You just had to port that from the, where it was to where it was behind the camera and that kind of thing to make it work in the portrayal.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so that got you started down the path of doing movies and other things. I mean, it's kind of interesting because you have tons of TV credits and you were on a lot of my favorite shows,
you know,
growing up. I mean, who wouldn't from the early 90s be watching Night Court? I would, you know, I mean, of course, you know, and Walker, Texas Ranger and Matlock. I mean, these are like staples for everybody to watch. So what was it like being on Walker, Texas Ranger? I mean, Chuck Norris.
Walker, Texas, he is one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. It was really fun because I got to fly. We were shooting in Texas, obviously. So I think it was maybe my first time in Texas. And we were shooting in like the Dallas area. And it was the first season of the show. But he was one of the sweetest, kindest people. And what I remember the most about that shoot is that he brought these kids on from the Make-A-Wish Foundation because they wanted to spend the day with Chuck Norris. And one of the they were like 12 and 14, I think. One of the boys had cancer and the other boy had been burned over like 90% of his body. And their wish was to come. So he would bring them on the days where he did the fight scenes and everything and bring them on the set. And they come in the makeup trailer and they just get to follow him around all day, which I thought was so beautiful. And they loved watching him in action. And I think he did that like almost for, I don't know if he did it for every episode, but that was like a big part of his life and giving back. So I was very taken with that and very taken with him. He was such a sweet, sweet man. And he also had like an acting coach there. He knew he wasn't like the greatest actor on the planet. And he had his acting coach there next to him the whole time. So he just was very humble and very kind and sweet. So I had a great time on that. I remember with the makeup artist and the guy who played my husband on it, we all went to like the Texas State Fair, which was really fun. The big state fair. I just got like a sweet taste of Texas.
I was going to say big state fair. Everything's bigger in Texas, I hear, you know. So of
course. Everything. I was a vegetarian at the time. You don't want to be a vegetarian in Texas. Not the place to be a vegetarian.
Especially at the state fair. I mean, of all the places.
I know. Oh my gosh. All that like smoked barbecue smelled so good.
Did it break you down? Did you succumb to the meat at the time or were you able to hold off?
I might have tasted a little. I mean, come on. When in Texas.
That's true. I mean, I don't know if I was a vegetarian. I don't know if I'd be able to resist, you know, when you're there and you got all those great smells going on and everything else. Yeah. I mean, you know, come on.
Yeah. And it was, I will say, delicious.
And then you got to work on the Matlock and you got Andy Griffith to me is like an icon. You know, the Andy Griffith show, Matlock, you just enjoy his acting and how he's able to go through playing these different roles.
He's a master.
So what was it like, you know, working, you know, on the set with him? And I know a lot of times I was told that he had like a timed thing, you know, so he would sometimes leave the set earlier so that because being older, they didn't want to wear him out. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how much time you had with him.
I had a lot of time with him. I mean, you know, so Dan Roebuck was on it too at the time. And Dan, I don't know if you know this, but we've been friends since I was like 19 years old. Dan and I met in California. I was 19. I think he was 21. He had just come out to LA. And we've been really, really like great friends ever since. So I booked to the Matlock. It was kind of great because it was a two-parter. So it ended up being like a movie of the week that they kept reshowing. And it was when they had moved to Wilmington, North Carolina. They were filming there. So I went there and it was around, we shot like in December. And it was pretty great because we shot out like on one of those Outer Banks kind of islands and it was closed for the winter. So the casting crew had the run of the whole resort. It was really fun. And Andy was so sweet. I mean, I came in as one of Dan's best friends. So Andy instantly loved me. I instantly loved him. He was so funny and such a curmudgeon in a good way. I ended up dating the guy who was the boom operator on that. We sort of got together and ended up dating for a few months and Andy loved that. He called the guy Love Bone because he was the boom operator and he was Love Bone, Marsha, get over here. What are you kids up to? You know, and stuff like that. So he was just so fun. And I don't think they were worried about wearing him out because he had like endless energy. I just think Andy had learned the secret to working in television and he never changed his suit in Matlock. Do you ever notice that? He always wears the same suit. So he never had costume changes. He didn't have to deal with that. He would come in and all the courtroom scenes, they would just shoot his side and all his dialogue in the morning. So he'd be done by like noon. And I don't think that's because he would get worn out. He was just like, I've paid my dues. I can do this, you know? So for me, I had like three or four scenes in the courtroom. So because you're filming Andy's side, I'm sitting behind him. So I kept having to change my costume and my hair for every separate scene. And then when we went back and shot my side, I had to change my costume and change my hair, all of the things. And I was like, you know what? He knows what he's doing. Never changes his hair, never changes his clothes. So, but he was a pro. I mean, everything was memorized. Everything was on. He was like watching a pro in action.
I was going to say, I still remember, I think they did one episode, at least one, where one of his daughters made him change his outfit, gave him a new suit. And
that's funny.
And the whole time he was just so uncomfortable with it, like itching, all the stuff. And it was just a funny episode because it's just this ongoing little plot with the story going on in the episode and he finally got out of it because he's, I can't think straight. I'm in this suit. Like, I'm not comfortable. And because he's like the Columbo of attorneys,
right.
You know, you expect to see him a certain way and do a certain things. And I love how they just spoofed it a little bit. That's like, so there were at least one time, but you're right. I think he was smart. I think he wore that same suit that he had to put on through that whole episode. So he stayed consistent. So he didn't have to do the wardrobe changes.
Right. The other fun thing for me was for Dan and I to be in a TV show together finally, because we had auditioned for parts and we usually he would get cast and I wouldn't because he worked all the time. But then the funny thing was we got out there and I literally only have like one scene with him, maybe two, I think in the courtroom, but we never have lines with each other or anything, but it didn't matter. We had a great time.
I was gonna say, you're making up for that time now in the last several years, but I know Andy Griffith is always known to be playing the guitar and singing. And since you guys were at North Carolina for a couple of weeks, were there times when there's down things where everybody was carousing that you got to hear him sing or play?
There weren't down times, but they did add a scene in the thing where he is playing in it. He brings his guitar in and he plays something and it was kind of ad-libbed. And it was like this extra little scene that they kind of threw in. So he was actually playing and singing in it, which was really fun.
I know back when the Andy Griffith show, and I think he did the same thing with Matlock when he had Don Knotts on there, especially like they used to have like, oh, we have an extra minute or 2 minutes or whatever to get to the episode length. And they would ad lib something for the end. And because the two of them were so good. And I think you could tell when it gets to the end of a Matlock episode where you can tell when he had the extra time, because usually he's going to play something on the guitar or there's some little skit. And I find that great where you have people that know their characters well enough where they could just ad lib something to get the episodes at the proper length.
Yes. I love that. And I'm sure, you know, by the time the show moved to North Carolina, then Andy sort of had control over the show too. So that's when he brought Dan in, because he had always wanted to bring Dan onto the show. And you could tell he was just having fun.
Because the show needed Cliff. I mean, of course, you know.
Of course it did. This is amazing.
I mean, we'll get to Danny in just a second, but just before we go into your Danny Roebuck phase with movies and everything, I did not know that you guys knew each other for so long. I figured you probably met around Matlock, but I didn't know you knew each other years prior to that. You did a bunch of Law and Order episodes, Law and Order Special Victims Unit, and Law and Order Criminal Intent. You're in Law and Order proper, so you were in the area. Is this because at the time you were living in New York?
Yes, I live in New York, and that helps. That helps. But the first one that I did, I guest starred on it, and the guy who played my husband or played my brother on the episode is now my husband in real life. Just so you know, we met on Law and Order. We played like psycho incestuous brother and sister, and I had murdered our mother by pushing her out the window, and he covered for me, and he went to prison and I got off scot-free, but he's now my husband. We've been together. Our anniversary is actually on Saturday. We've been married 23 years.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. But it's really fun to watch that episode because I can go, oh, I met you right before that scene and all of that. So that's one of the best Law and Order stories. It's also a great way when people say, oh, how did you guys meet? And you go, oh, we were guest starring on Law and Order.
I was a psycho, and you know, and I killed somebody, and you know, and yeah, and the relationship just took off from there.
Just brother and sister. Yeah. So it's really amazing to me how they reuse you on the shows. It's kind of so great, and you would think that people would notice, but I think I've worked for the same director in three different episodes, and even he like didn't necessarily remember me from the episodes that he had directed. So I'm sure the people watching don't really notice that you're playing all these different characters.
Well, I think it goes back to, if you have good actors, and this goes back to the Perry Mason shows and like Matlock and all, and Agatha Christie, Angela Lansbury with Murder, She Wrote, where they had so many different actors in a staple that they'd rotate. Some of them would be year to year, like every year they're back for another thing where they could be the villain, or they could play multiple villains. They could just be a decoy character, but the acting is so good that you don't realize they're playing all these. It's the same person, and that's the tribute to, I think, if somebody's doing multiple episodes on the same show coming back, I think it's an attribute to your ability to be able to perform these different things, where even the director didn't know you were back. I mean, come on, the director of all the people you think would be the one that would know if you were in this, in the scenes before, you know, the shots before, the things like that, unless it was a long gap in between. But
I mean, it'd been a year maybe, or 2 years or something. But, and then when I reminded, his name was Jean de Guzignac, and when I would remind him, he'd go, "Oh my gosh, I knew there was some reason I like you," you know, whatever. But yeah.
And that's what I love about it. You know, I think so. It's just a testimony, because I've seen you in many different things, like I said, and you're able to bring each role where it's like you're different. You know, there's some similarities, but there's a lot of differences, because some of them you're playing a mother in a couple of them. So it's not like it's too different of a role. But you know, looking at, I've watched a lot of your different things in prep for the interview, and of course, some of them it's pretty easy because I just pulled the DVD off the shelf because I have all the Matlock episodes. And
great.
You know, it's like, okay, let's put it. My wife loves Matlock. You know, that is like one of her, she can watch those over and over and over. So I literally got her all the episodes. And, you know, by getting her all the episodes, of course, I have all the episodes. So it was a win-win.
It is a win-win. I love that. My parents loved it too. They were so excited. Well, they loved Danny. They knew Danny really well. They loved that he was on it, and then they loved that I got to go do it. So,
and speaking of loving Danny Roebuck, I interviewed him a couple times, and he's good, you know, already, and he's amazing talent, and how he's able to, I should say, he's a performer. I mean, really, he's more than an actor; he's a performer.
Yeah, he's the best.
And in a lot of these films, he brings you in. And I know I've seen you, the first one I saw was Getting Grace of his, and you played a mom in that. And for those that don't know, if you want to give them an idea what Getting Grace is about.
So Getting Grace is about a teenage girl named Grace who's dying of cancer. And she kind of befriends this funeral director played by Dan Roebuck, who's very closed off to the world. And sort of throughout the course of the movie, she kind of opens up everybody's lives and teaches them how to live while she's sadly passing away. I play her mother, who's an alcoholic mess, obviously, because her daughter's dying. And what I love about the film is that Grace wants to make sure that everyone is okay. And once she makes sure everyone in her life is okay, then she can pass. And it's such a beautiful story of this young girl, like, facing head on what she's dealing with and just going, okay, I have limited time, so I'm going to try to make the world a better place before I go.
And as I said earlier, you and Danny played there's a couple other characters you said that had their eyes open, but the people that are playing it, you two are the main characters that have their lives changed the most by Grace. And of course, the movie focuses mostly on her and Danny's funeral director character. Right. And of course, she's trying to set you up with perspective bows, and he's one of them. And that's where some of the comedy comes in with some of these scenes, but also they're so touching in that the living room where everybody is like sleeping, like on the, like, it's like as a sleepover on the floor. And then there's so touching scenes that are going on.
Yeah. And did you notice who plays the other suitor in the movie? So Dan is kind of rivaled by Dana Ashbrook, who was in my zombie movie with me, which I was very happily brought Dana into the film. So that was so fun to be work with him again, too, because he was living in New York at the time.
And then, because if I remember, he's the character with that is the mentalist.
The writer. Yeah, the mentalist, exactly, who can bend spoons with his mind, yeah.
Which comes to play at the end of this movie, which I'm not going to spoil it yet. Well, you kind of told the ending. It's one of those movies you can tell how it's going to end at the beginning on some parts, yeah. But there's other parts that go on. And what I love about Danny Roebuck's movies is that, yes, they have a faith element to it, but it's not a heavy-handed beat you over the head part. It's there.
Yeah. It's just more about, like, yes, there's faith in them, but he doesn't say what faith that has to be, you know? They're more about, like, love and God and life and being kind to people. And, you know, they're more about that kind of thing and living like a good life. You can say a Christian life or you can say a Buddhist life or whatever. He doesn't care what the religion is. He just wants to make movies that touch people, I think.
And I love that because I used to be a Boy Scout leader. And of course, one of the things is, you know, faith is one of the elements, but also it was a multi-denominational type thing. So as long as you had some kind of faith, and I think people don't realize that when they hear faith-based, they automatically assume it's one type of faith, but no, the best ones are the ones that encompass everything. Let the story lead you.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I think, you know, I mean, there are a lot of Christian films they really do hit you over the head with the sort of Christian tenets and all of that. And Dan just subtly brings it in there. Like it's almost like a God presence, you know, it's not like, oh, I don't know, but he does. I think he makes movies that tell beautiful stories about good people and people who want to help other people, you know, which is, I think, what basic Christianity should be.
Mm-hmm. Or just a good neighbor policy. Just no, just be careful.
Yeah, or anything. Just as a person. Yeah, like a humanity. Exactly.
So I'm assuming that he probably wrote the role for you, or did he actually make you audition?
He did not make me audition. However, when we get to the Hail Mary, which is our next movie coming out, I did audition for that. So originally, I think he had the script for like 9 years. It was originally called Bending Spoons, and it was written by this guy, Jeff Lewis, I believe. And it was set in Saginaw, Michigan, because that's where Jeff was from. And it's a true story about his niece who passed from cancer. And Dan got the script, and he was going to co-direct it, maybe? I can't remember if he was going to direct it. Anyway, as soon as he read that role of Venus, he called me, and he's like, Marsha, you need to play this role. This role is you. And I was like, okay. I mean, not that I'm an alcoholic, but, you know, whatever. The person who was going to put the money into the film when it was in that form decided not to. So the film kind of fell apart getting made. And so then Dan kind of got the rights to it and rewrote it with Jeff. And then he's like, I'm going to set it in Bethlehem and try to raise the money to do it in Bethlehem. And he changed the title from Bending Spoons to Getting Grace. And then he really kind of tailored the role to me. You know, there you can tell certain lines in it and everything. It's like he just totally wrote it for me at that point. And I was so happy because Dan and I mean, I think he's written probably two or three other movies since we've known each other, maybe more, that we're like, okay, let's star in this together. And to finally get to do it, like, I think I had turned 50 the summer we filmed, and it was just so unbelievable that we've known each other for so long, and we finally got to do the films together that we have always dreamt about doing together. And it, the fact that it just keeps continuing, it makes me so happy. I can't even tell you.
What I love about your performance is you obviously, because you're using the alcohol to cope with everything that's going on with Grace. And it's those scenes show. And it's, you're going through, and you're going through this mindset of handling as a single parent, a thing that no parent ever wants to go through. And you're using this coping mechanism, and then Grace tries to help have you get out of it. And then Danny's character steps in as the person who's going, like, I'm going to help assist you with this path, you know, and right. But not knowing exactly what to do, but trying to do the best he can. And I think the scene that you both have in the bathroom, mm-hmm. where you're drunk and he's trying to do this and that, and then you basically have that row. That was a brilliant scene. And I don't know if you want to elaborate more about what, like, how much of it was scripted and how much you guys maybe worked it out with each other.
Oh, thanks. A lot of it was actually scripted that way. Certain things weren't. You know, for me, I just kind of had to go into that state and sort of stick in that state. And then once you're in that place of acting, I think that you're so outside of yourself in a way that you just kind of go with it, and whatever happens, happens. So I know, like, a lot of the dialogue was scripted, but then me, like, going down to the floor and just sobbing, like, that wasn't, it was just, there were certain things that, you know, and when I work with Dan, he's so intuitive and so spontaneous as well. Like, we just trust each other 100%. So we just kind of, it was a combo, I would say. Stuff was written and then we just fleshed it out and added stuff, and it just kind of flowed and worked, I think.
And that's, I mean,
it's a hard scene to shoot, yeah.
I could tell that you both were being true to your characters. And that, I think once you know your character, you're able to go, and it's like, oh, and at that moment you just realize, oh, I have to go down. And this, you know, and
yeah. It just hits you. Things just hit you and things just happen. So.
And you got to work with, in her first movie, you know, Daniel Roebuck's fine, Madeline Dundon, you know, and here she is, you know, thrust upon being the main character of this movie and have to make everything work. And I loved about her is the way she says her dialogue. It's like her voice is unique. You know, and I hear her speak, I know that's her. And I think, and that's a positive, because there's so many people, you hear them and it's just, there's nothing unique about them. With her, she's quirky and good and unique. And I think that she has the ability to, because of that, to go a long way, because she stands out. You remember her. But what was it like?
Yeah, I think, she's magnificent. I love her. I actually just sent her a text. It's her birthday yesterday. And I'm like, hi, surrogate daughter. Your other mama loves you. You know, happy birthday. I think she's brilliant. I mean, I think her performance in that movie is beyond, and the fact that she'd never even been on a movie set before that just blows my mind. The fact that she had just graduated from high school and could be that tapped in and that good and that natural. I think she's astonishing. I love her dearly, dearly.
And for listeners, when you look at the trailer and definitely see the movie, she did shave her head, because I've interviewed her for the movie, and she suffered if you listen to that interview, it was interesting when she went to college, because people thought she was a different type of person because her hair was still growing back. It was just at that, like a, like Sinead O'Connor styling, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Her little pixie. Yeah. I remember she and her mom went out and bought a couple of really good wigs for her to take to college, but I don't know if she ever really wore them, but I saw her wear them a couple times and they looked amazing on her. So. But her hair grew back so fast. But yeah, I mean, Dan, when he was looking for the character of Grace, he made it very clear that they were going to have to shave their head, because we didn't have the time to spend hours in a makeup chair covering all of that up and everything. So she did it willingly. She's so beautiful too. Gosh, who knew she'd be so beautiful bald?
Well, I think it's because the inside of the character was so pure, and she was able to portray it so well that it's just, you know, it's they do say that your inner beauty will always shine through regardless.
Yes, and she's got that in spades.
Definitely.
She's a beautiful person.
Now, I don't live far from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I'm just a couple hours away. And I was born in a little town called Edinburgh, Pennsylvania, which is way northwest of there. So I know what it's like to have a little bit of small town growing up. I don't know where you grew up at. Did you grow up in a small town?
I did. I grew up in Ohio. I grew up mostly in a little town called Sydney, Ohio, which has maybe 25,000 people or so. And then when I was in high school, I moved to Springfield, Ohio. So that's kind of, and that's where I continue to go back every year. I still have great friends from high school that I go and we have girls' nights out and stuff like that. And yeah, I love it. So yeah, I'm a total small town Ohio girl for sure.
So what was it like?
Which is probably partly why Dan and I bonded so well. I find Midwesterners kind of seek each other out. Although I don't know if Bethlehem's considered Midwestern, but it feels like it's probably more Eastern, but it definitely has that wonderful, like, Midwestern family kind of feel to it.
Or to find a comment, let's say the small town feel. Because I think if you grow up in a small town, there's certain shorthands that everybody knows what it's like if you grew up in that atmosphere. Just like if you grew up in a city, there's certain things you just know, regardless of what major city it is. You kind of like, there's a lot of commonality.
True.
What was it like filming in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania? Because one thing Dan does in his films is he really showcases the town.
Yeah. You know, I've always loved Bethlehem because I moved to New York, in like the early 90s. And so when Dan and his then wife, Kelly, they had two little kids, Grace and Buster, they would come to Bethlehem like for Halloween or for Christmas and stuff. And I would always visit them from New York. So I fell in love with that, and we'd stay at the Hotel Bethlehem, and I was like, this is the greatest hotel I've ever been in, and all this stuff. And so I already loved the town. So the fact that we got to go and film there just made me so happy. I love that. I consider it like my second home. I don't know if they'll have me, but I want them. Sorry, I'm letting my dog out. Pixie, go. Mom is working.
And what kind of dog is...
He's a Portuguese water dog named Pixie.
Oh, for people that can't see, he's beautiful.
She looks like a llama's dog. She is so sweet. I love her. Anyway, I know we'll probably get to this, but Dan and I are in the process of filming a Christmas movie there called Saint Nick of Bethlehem. And we started filming last November, and I don't think I've ever been happier in my life on a movie set. Because my fantasy is to be in a Christmas movie and to be in a Christmas movie in Bethlehem, which is like the best Christmas city, I was so freaking happy.
The Hallmark movie where they had the Bethlehem Christmas, this is actually filmed in Bethlehem. So it's
exactly. I think our movie was called Saint Nick at first, and then Dan's like, I have to add the Bethlehem because they're faking us out and this is real.
I wonder how he was chagrined when he probably saw that movie coming out, you know, and he's like, oh no, it's not really in Bethlehem. Oh, geez. I gotta defend my turf.
Exactly. And I think that was partly why he's like, we gotta get this made now. We gotta make it now before that one. I think it might've come out this year, but I bet nobody watched it. It was fake.
It came out last Christmas. My wife watches, she watches all the Hallmark movies. So I know, that's why I know it did come out. But the thing is, people aren't going to remember that one. It's not memorable.
No, exactly.
The one where you have Daniel Roebuck looking like, I've seen pictures of him on Facebook and everything. He looks like Saint Nick. I mean, he pulls it off.
He really does. He really does. And I'm just so happy to be doing that with him too. We're coming back. We're finishing shooting next week. We start finishing like for the last 2 weeks. In Bethlehem, we did most of the exteriors in November so we could get all the lights and all of that stuff. And now we're finishing up the interiors.
And I know that the town came out to help you because you guys did a parade scene and everything. And it was amazing.
I know. That's the thing. Like, Dan, I don't think could make these movies anywhere else but Bethlehem because the community is so super supportive. I mean, I think he just put out a thing on Facebook that morning, like, if you want to be in the movie, come down. And we had like 300 or 400 people there lined up and ready to go. And it was unbelievable. And I don't think that could happen in any other like community that way. They really do like support him there. I tell him he should be the mayor someday. No offense to the current mayor. He's a really nice guy, but, the community just loves that he comes there, I think, and highlights the community and highlights the businesses there and all of that stuff and sort of shines a light on the Lehigh Valley.
He's definitely the unofficial ambassador of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. That, I think, is...
I agree.
They should just make it official.
I agree.
You know, if they haven't done it already, they might have. I don't know. You know, it's just...
I think he's like a St. Luke's ambassador. He's like the Hotel Bethlehem ambassador because they're two of our big corporate sponsors. They've been incredible in supporting the film. So he's working his way up to the ambassador of the entire town.
Well, there you go. And we should start a campaign, you know, hashtag make Danny ambassador.
Let's do it.
And that way, when I have him come on, it's like, I got this ambassador thing coming. It's like, oh yeah, I don't know where that started.
Let's do it.
Listeners, you know what to do now. Do it.
Hashtag. Now, Mr. Dan Roebuck, Bethlehem ambassador.
As I say, the next movie you guys did together that came out, and I got to meet you briefly at the premiere, mm-hmm. one of the two premieres. It was a double premiere day. I was at the second one where we had a little bit of the rain issue that was going on, but Lucky Louie.
Yes. That was really wonderful because it was during COVID and, you know, the whole world had shut down and Dan had just announced, I think the day before, you know, March 12th, the whole big shutdown of everything, that we were going to make the Hail Mary that summer in the Lehigh Valley. And it's a much bigger film with a much bigger cast and crew. And he was like, oh, I guess this isn't happening. So the beauty of what happened is that he sat down with his daughter, Grace, because nobody was working. And they wrote the script together. And he called me one day in the summer and he said, he calls me Marshmallow. and Mellow, that's been shortened to Mellow. So he's like, hey, Mellow, Grace and I are writing a script and we want you to be a part of it. And we're hoping to shoot in September. And I was like, during COVID? And he's like, yeah, I think it's a small movie. We'll use a skeleton crew and we'll all just wear masks and let's do it. And so I was like, great. And we went and it was so incredible to be able to work and be on a set with a lot of people that I've known, you know, a lot of the actors, almost all of them were family friends of Dan's and people that I've known for years. Willard Pugh, who plays my husband in it, I met when I was 18 out in Los Angeles. And so it was so fun to reconnect with him and to be sort of in this little, we created like the little bubble, you know, of the cast and crew, and we all were very safe. And I think we lucked out too because we filmed it at a time where things were just starting to open up again, you know, like slowly but surely. So the COVID levels were very, very low. And yeah, we got through that entire movie. Not a single person got COVID. Everyone was very respectful and very safe. And we were able to create this sweet, funny, you know, small film that I think is super entertaining.
Oh, I agree. And listeners, this movie just became available on DVD, so you can get it at Amazon, and you can also stream it, I believe, on Amazon Prime. But one thing I always push, because this is independent filmmakers, and I have a lot of independent filmmakers that come on the show, you can stream it, yes, and get to watch the movie. They're happy with that. They obviously put it there. They're getting pennies from when you stream it, where if you buy the physical media, they're actually getting a much more substantial percentage of the proceeds, which helps fund the next movie, the next project.
That's
so if you
enjoy
these projects, get Getting Grace on DVD, get Lucky Louie on DVD. But if you're not sure if you're going to like it or not, stream it. And if you enjoy it, it's almost like, I call it now tip the filmmaker. If you enjoyed that movie and want to see more work, buy the physical media as a tip, because you're tipping them, they're going to get the money from it, and then you get to see the movie as many times as you want. because you never know if it's going to be streaming down the road.
It's true. And I think another place that you can buy the DVDs for any of the movies that we've done is it's Dan's nonprofit called achannelofpeace.org. And if you go to achannelofpeace.org, I believe you can probably buy the DVDs through that as well. I'm not positive, but you could check that out. And that's a great website anyway, because if you want to contribute or be a part of it, they list, you know, when they're casting, they list when they're hiring crew members, extras, you know, all that stuff. So it's a great way to just sort of check out what's being done. Now, St. Nick of Bethlehem is a different, we're not doing that under a Channel of Peace. So it has its own website, I think. Maybe stnickofbethlehem.com. I'm not sure. But anyway, you can Google that and figure that out too.
Well, I think in Facebook, you can follow Daniel Roebuck on there. And you can also follow Channel of Peace. And I think in both sites, they're posting when these things are happening. So if you want to know
exactly
what's going on, definitely recommend you follow those. And that way
Instagram, and it's on Facebook and Instagram. Yeah.
Yeah. Social media. It's everywhere.
It is.
Now, you alluded to the Hail Mary, which is not out yet, and in that movie, and I'm really looking forward to, because it's another Daniel Roebuck movie, and I'm curious, you know, I think it takes place at a Catholic school or something like that, and it has something to do with football.
Yes, so it takes place. There's a beautiful place in what's the town? I'm blanking. Oh my gosh. It's right. It's just by Bethlehem. Anyway, Northampton, Pennsylvania. And it's an old, it was a school for priests, it was a seminary, and it's called the Mary Immaculate Seminary. And it's been empty for years. And I remember when we did the Getting Grace premiere in Bethlehem, Dan went up there. There was this crazy snowstorm the day before the premiere, like crazy snowstorm. Like Dana and I drove from New York together, and it took us like 3.5 hours to get to Bethlehem, which is usually 1 hour and 45 minutes. And Dan went up in the middle of this snowstorm to see this seminary and just filmed some stuff. And he got the idea to write this movie, The Hail Mary. So it's an all boys Catholic high school. It's run by the Mother Superior, Sister Kathy, and that's who I play, and the nuns, and their kids who are at-risk youth, so they don't have great family lives, or they've gotten in trouble or whatever, and so it's that kind of school. And she kind of cons Dan into coming and being like the maintenance man at the school, because he's like this down-and-out drunk, basically. And while he's there, she cons him again into starting a football team with the boys. Yeah.
Leads him down a certain path.
What's that?
Leads him down a certain path. Instead of using the word con, you know, we'll make it more, we'll sound a little better.
She does. She's amazing. And he based her on this nun, Sister Kathy, that was his kindergarten teacher, who really, like when he was 5, he said, "I'm going to write a play." And she said, "Okay." And then he wrote the play, and then she said, "Well, let's put on the play." And so she really encouraged his artistic career and his artistic sensibilities. And so this is a real tribute to the three, Sister Kathy, Sister Margaret Anthony, and Sister Clara, maybe is the third one. Anyway, these are the nuns that he wrote these characters sort of based on. And yeah, Sister Kathy is probably my favorite role I've ever played, honestly.
And you said you had to audition for this role.
Yes, because so Dan had written the script maybe 4 years before we made it. And he sent me the script and I read it and I was like, I have to play Sister Kathy. And he's like, Marshmallow, I know you could do it, but I just don't see you as the character. She should be really short and she should be this. You know, he was seeing his real Sister Kathy. And I said, okay. He's like, I think you're going to play the mom of the dead kid. So when I got the script, the mom of the dead kid, I was like, she doesn't even have a line. I said, I don't want to play the mom of the dead kid. Yeah. I said, at least let me be a nun. And he kept saying, you're too pretty to be a nun, Marcia. I'm like, no, go ahead. Let me at least be one of the nuns. So finally, when it was like a month before shooting, he goes, okay, I want you to play Sister Clara. And I was like, okay, great. Great. I'll be Sister Clara. I said, but, and he goes, but, and I have this woman that I think is going to be Sister Kathy, but she's never been in a movie before. He was like discovering another kind of Maddie Dundon, right? Like a new person. And I said, okay. I said, okay. And then he goes, but you know, if it doesn't work out, you're my backup. And I said, all right, well, why don't you just let me, why don't we just get together and read through a couple scenes? So just let me just read it with you. And he goes, okay. So I went out to Bethlehem. I was going to wear like buck teeth as Sister Clara. I was going to have like a Wisconsin accent and stuff because I was like trying to do something fun. And I said, okay, Dan, let's just go read these. He goes, well, I don't really have time. I said, Dan, come on. I had to force him to read the scenes with me. We literally sat in the stairwell at the hotel. And I was like, okay. And then he goes, oh, I don't have my reading glasses. I'm like, I'll get my computer. I mean, he did everything he could to not let me do this. And then I read the two scenes and he goes, okay, now I'm going off and auditioning the rest of the people. I'll let you know. And I just said, look, I'm happy to play Sister Clara. Just wanted you to see what I could maybe do as Sister Kathy. And he was like, okay. And then I went off to Ohio and then he called me, we Zoomed. And he was like, it was one of those moments where Zoom freezes. He goes, okay, Mello, I want you to play Sister Kathy. And I was like, Clara or Kathy? He goes, no, I want you to play Sister Kathy. Oh my God. And finally goes, Gabby, I want you to play Sister Gabby. And I was like, yay. Anyway, so I got to play this wonderful role and I was so, oh, I just loved her so much. We had the best time filming this movie.
I'm so looking forward to when it comes out. I know, again, if you follow Channel of Peace, you'll know when it's coming. And I know, a lot of times it's distribution deals and other things. And there's all these behind the scenes stuff that happens, especially with independent films. And that's, again, Channel of Peace is a nonprofit. Totally. You know, Daniel Roebuck, nope, yeah. As he says, nobody named Roebuck gets any money from.
It's true.
So it goes straight to making the movie. And that's mm-hmm. all you can ask for. And a lot of times when they do the premieres, they do things to help with the different charity organizations that are around Bethlehem.
That's true. I know we did three different premieres for Getting Grace, and one was for the School of the Arts, and one was for Pediatric Cancer Foundation there, and one was for maybe St. Luke's Hospital or something. There were three different organizations, and we did the same for Lucky Louie. I forget who we gave it to, but yeah, no, he does. Dan definitely gives back a lot. I went and did some screen. We did a special screening for St. Luke's employees, and he asked me to come. So we came and they got to take pictures with us and do a talk back with us and everything. And that was just for people who work at St. Luke's Hospital. And that was really fun.
But I want to thank you for joining me and helping me out with talking about your career and your experiences of working with Dan Roebuck. You know, it's been a joy to have you on, Miss Bennett.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad you reached out and I can't wait to hear it.
I want to thank Marcia Dietlin Bennett for allowing me to interview her. And I hope everybody enjoyed that episode. If you have any feedback, please send us emails at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message on our Facebook page. I hope everybody enjoyed it. Not only do we do movie discussions and interviews, but we have that sub-series of Hammerama, where Alistair Hughes and I talk about different Hammer films once a month. And I'm going to play that promo for that. So if you want to have more idea what that show is about, I hope everybody has a good day. Bye.
I'm Al from New Zealand.
And I'm Stephen from Maryland, USA.
We are Hammerama. Welcome to our new podcast, Enter Freely, and of your own will.
Part of the multi-award-nominated diecast movie podcast, Hammerama is a wide look at the world of Hammer horror from either side of the globe.
Each month, we will throw a die to decide which category from the film vault of Hammer we are going to discuss. The Dracula, Frankenstein, or Mummy Cycles, science fiction, prehistory, or the experimental 1970s.
We will cast our international eyes across then and now, reviews of the movie,
its place in the Hammerverse,
our encounters with the stars,
a film poster critique,
and unusual associated merchandise.
So join us for our bite-sized discussion of Hammer's gory glories, stitched together from both ends of the earth.
Hammerama is a proud part of the Diecast Movie Podcast.